audiobook.com.
Well, what's up, everybody? Thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, January 11th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We're going to go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me for this Hump Day show. We're going to talk some basketball to kick things off with Chris Stone, who has bylines at Fansided, Rush the Court, The Step Back, pretty much all over the place. Really, really strong college basketball writer. So we'll get some thoughts from him on today's program. Also, second half of today's show, be joined by Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds on the number one on Twitter. We'll go over the NFL playoffs for this weekend with the divisional round, and then also talk about the Sony Open in Hawaii, the second PGA Tour event here of 2017, the first full field event of 2017. So should have a lot of things to discuss there with him. I'll also update you about the rest of the week along the way. But we'll go ahead and bring in today's first guest. That is Chris Stone of Fansided and Rush the Court. Chris, how's it going today, man?
Good. How are you?
Doing very well. Appreciate your time. Good to get you back on the program here. Been a little while since we've been able to chat with
you. Absolutely.
You know, I think that the best place to start here for our segment is one of the things that we've kind of talked about a little bit here on previous shows as we've been transitioning more into the basketball side is that a lot of people that are picking up college basketball at this stage of the game want to back the teams that they know, the perennial contenders, the teams that they're very familiar with. So what I wanted to do here on this segment is take a couple of minutes, look at some of these teams and, you know, sort of evaluate where they are right now, if they're going to be a trustworthy team going forward. And I would say that the best one to talk about here right out of the chute, one that lost last night and didn't look very good in the process, is the Duke Blue Devils. Now, Florida State's a really quality team this year. There's no doubt about that. They're going to be a top 10 team, at least for the foreseeable future. But this is a lot more than just Coach K not being on the sidelines, right?
Yeah, it is. Duke, I think the number that I saw, has played 15 of their 17 games without one of their starters. So they've been dealing pretty consistently throughout the entire year with various injuries or suspensions to Grayson Allen for tripping people. And so there's a lot of consistency problems. And I think one of the things that was a question for Duke coming into the season was how all of the pieces would fit with a bunch of really good veterans coming back and then a bunch of really good freshmen. You have to figure out how to make all of that work together. And then you had Luke Kennard develop into an All-American type player, which I don't think anybody expected to see. And so now you have kind of Grayson Allen, Luke Kennard, Jason Tatum, all really good scorers. And the question is, how can you make all of those pieces fit? And I think you run into some problems there. Last night, they missed Emile Jefferson, who's kind of the heart and soul of their defense. I think Florida State shot close to 60% on twos in that game. And so it's really just this question of when can Duke get everyone together playing at the same time at the level we know that they're all capable of, and kind of move past where they've been for these first four ACC games where they're only 2-2 and their only two wins are over the two worst teams in the league.
Well, and we'll find out in a hurry here how Duke makes adjustments because they play Saturday against Louisville in that noon tip-off time and that one on the road for them. So, I mean, you know, that's one of the things that I look for in college basketball is I want to see how these teams play in November at the start and then how they're playing in late February and into March. Do you feel like there are, so to speak, too many cooks in the kitchen here with this Duke team, or do you feel like they will – kind of start to settle into a rhythm, particularly, you know, whenever Coach K returns to the sidelines?
So I think right now it's pretty easy to make the argument that there's too much going on. Early in the season when Jason Tatum wasn't in the lineup, Duke was sharing the ball. They moved it really well. They got all kinds of open shots for guys. And that's kind of when Luke Kennard was doing his best work, I think. And then you add Tatum, who is a really great player, no question, but he is kind of an old-school type player in that he likes to play in the mid-range and he likes to play in these isolations where the ball doesn't quite move as much. And so you kind of have to figure out, well, how do we integrate that with what we're already doing? And when you have players missing, it becomes harder to do that. So I think, at least in the short term, there's still a lot of adjustments that are going on because they're still working players back in the lineup. Like, they're going to have to figure out what to do with Harry Giles when he is hopefully fully healthy and you know, he's the top-ranked recruit. Like, he probably deserves some minutes. And so, but we're a long ways from March still, and I think that eventually they're going to figure all of that out, and you might get the kind of national title contender that everybody thought we would eventually see out of them. And I think probably people were too optimistic that that would happen quickly. But I think at least in the short term, there's some difficulties there of figuring out what everybody's role should be.
Well, we'll bring this full circle here in a second, but the next team to touch on is Louisville. And the Cardinals this year, 13-3, they've got that win that everybody watched against Kentucky. They didn't follow it up all that well. They lost to Virginia, bounced back against Indiana, then a loss at South Bend against Notre Dame. So they're just 1-2 here in conference play. They play Duke on Saturday, so that's why I'm going to this team next. But what do you see from Louisville this year? I mean, their other loss is a three-point loss to Baylor, who was the number one team, and of course they got blown out last night by West Virginia. So what do you think the current status of the Cardinals is?
Well, the one thing you know that you're always going to get with Louisville is a really, really good defense. They play that kind of strange matchup zone, and this year they have a lot of long players, both at the wing and on the interior. According to KenPom, they've got the number one defense in the country that's even better than that West Virginia team that's turning everybody over at a crazy rate. Louisville does a great job of pressuring the perimeter, preventing three-point looks. They do a great job of protecting the rim. They've got a couple of guys inside that are big seven-footers who can kind of help that. So you know you're going to get a team that can kind of stop opponents from scoring and who can turn them over a little bit. The problem, I think, in the ACC with their two losses, the one was at home to Virginia. Virginia is historically a great team at protecting the ball, not committing those same types of turnovers. They slow the pace down, and they're just a really efficient scoring offense. And then the other loss came at Notre Dame, which is just like one of the better offensive teams in the country, and sometimes those offensive teams are just going to get hot and your defense isn't going to matter as much. With Louisville, the question is, can they score enough points to keep up with those teams? They're a poor shooting team from the outside. They do a great job on the offensive boards, but they're still not a particularly efficient offense because they miss so many shots. And so, you know, it's a question of how long or how far can that defense really carry them, even though their offense is somewhat questionable.
Well, and I previewed over at bangthebook.com today's game between Pitt and Louisville. Pitt opened a 12-point dog. This number is down to 11, and it's actually showing signs of going even lower, maybe down to 10.5 or 10. One of the things that stood out to me here is that, you know, Pitt has a couple of really high usage guys that have been playing very, very well for them. On the other side, you've got Louisville, where their high usage players, Donovan Mitchell, Quentin Snyder, and Deng Adel, are all shooting 37% or below. So for Louisville here, I mean, do they need these top three guys, the only three guys in double figures, to really get it going? Or can they, on a regular basis, overcome that because they play defense so well?
I mean, you've seen some rotation, I think, where each of those guys kind of get off on certain nights and the other ones kind of fall to the back. I really think with Louisville, though, now that we're, 16, 17 games into the season, about at the midway point for them, I really think it's all just going to hinge on how well they defend and if they're able to stop teams from scoring. You know, if they can create some turnovers and get easy transition buckets, that makes a big deal because you're not going to have a lot of nights where they're going to go out and hit a ton of shots from outside the arc and just like outrun somebody in terms of scoring. Like when they played Kentucky, for example, that was a 73-70 game that was played at a slower pace compared to what Kentucky normally plays at. They're going to want to slow teams down, grind them out, play good defense, and beat them that way. And sometimes that strategy is susceptible to certain players getting hot and you just get beat on certain nights. But I think, you know, ideally you would see those kind of high usage guys turn into better offensive players, but I just don't know that we have any evidence that suggests that's a thing that they're really capable of doing. And so I think Louisville's going to just be reliant mostly on their ability to defend and to shut other teams down.
Well, then we'll bring it full circle here. Duke and Louisville, as I said, they play coming up here on Saturday. My best guess for a number here, and I don't claim to have in-depth power ratings or anything like that, but my best guess is that Louisville's probably a 4.5-point favorite in this type of game, maybe a little bit higher given how Duke played without Emile Jefferson. We'll see if he's able to play on Saturday, and also without Coach K on the sidelines. So what do you see in a big-time premier, you know, blue-blood top 10 matchup like that one on Saturday?
Yeah, KenPom projects that one at 4 points for Louisville right now. It's a home game for Louisville. If Emile Jefferson doesn't play, Duke's going to be in a much more difficult position because one of those things that those guards for Louisville do is get into the lane. Like, they can penetrate. It's just a question of can they finish their shots when they get there. And if Duke is going to be reliant on Chase Jeter and kind of a still recovering Harry Giles, they could be in for a pretty long day. The other thing to consider about that matchup is that Duke doesn't really have a true point guard. They've protected the ball really well and haven't turned it over a lot this year, but I'm not sure that they've played defenses quite as good as Louisville's yet. And so you could see some turnovers for Duke if that Louisville defense really gets up in the grill. And so I think in that game, I like the Cardinals quite a bit more than I like the Blue Devils, especially assuming that Emile Jefferson won't be back by then.
One more ACC team I want to mention, and then we'll sort of bounce around the country a little bit. North Carolina. North Carolina is much more experienced than you would expect one of these types of programs to be, because you get a lot of one-and-done players, but there's a lot of upperclassmen here on this North Carolina team. Haven't played the greatest of schedules yet, lost to Kentucky, lost at Indiana, did beat Wisconsin, and crushed Oklahoma State earlier in the year, and Oklahoma State seems like they're a fairly decent team, although they're off to a slow start in Big 12 play. What do you look for from the Tar Heels this year? I mean, is this a national championship contender, or is this a case where this is a team that, you know, maybe just doesn't have what it takes this year?
You know, I think you get different answers on different nights, right? They beat Wisconsin pretty handily on a neutral earlier in the year, and you would have said, hey, this is a pretty good team. They played Kentucky close. They lost at Indiana. I think the loss that really sticks out is that loss at Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech is a really bad basketball team, and I think that seeing the Tar Heels kind of have a stinker like that is a little bit concerning. Now, you contrast that with what they did last Sunday when they played North Carolina State and they beat them by about 50 points at home. And North Carolina State is a team that has, you know, Dennis Smith, who's a surefire lottery pick in the NBA draft, Omer Yurtseven, potential first round pick, and then a bunch of other top rated recruits. And North Carolina just blew them out of the water by playing some really good defense. I do think that North Carolina is a national title contender because they can put it all together. In March, they're still a great offensive rebounding team, just like they were last season. They haven't had a drop-off without Bryce Johnson. They're a better shooting team than they've been in the past, which I think is really important. Justin Jackson, who's historically been a bad shooter, is now shooting the ball well. Joel Berry shooting it well. Kenny Williams is a sophomore who's shooting 34% from three right now, but really is somebody who will probably shoot better than that. And then it's also worth noting they're going to add Theo Pinson. I think he played his first game against North Carolina State. People expected kind of a breakout year for him. So in addition to being good shooting, they're also a much better defensive team than they've been in the past. Kennedy Meeks and Isaiah Hicks kind of controlling the paint, preventing teams from scoring on twos. But I think that they're prone to nights where they show up and they just don't have very good games. But they're also, you know, prone to games like the one that they had Sunday and against North Carolina State and, you know, in the NCAA tournament where it's six games and it's really short-term single elimination. They can certainly play at their peak and win a national title or, you know, just make the Final Four or whatever, but they can also have those stinkers that they had against Georgia Tech and go out early.
So when you look at a team like North Carolina here, looking more at a betting standpoint, is this one of those teams that when they play some lesser caliber competition, for example, they play Wake Forest tonight on the road, they've got Boston College coming up, you know, Virginia Tech, who's obviously had a couple of nice wins here this season. But when they're not playing those elite premier opponents, the Dukes, the Florida States, you know, the Notre Dames of the world, is this a team that you would probably look to stay away from then because you just may get some inconsistency? There's kind of a high variance, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's certainly what it seems like so far, right? Especially with a team like this that has struggled on the road in two games, right? They played Clemson to overtime or needed overtime to beat Clemson at Clemson in their second ACC game. It's weird because that's not necessarily something you would expect from a roster that's as experienced as North Carolina is with a lot of guys who are juniors and seniors. You would expect those guys to be kind of battle-tested and able to handle those road environments. But so far, it seems like there are some question marks about how good they're going to be on the road in those situations. And so I think at least in the interim, I might stay away from them just because I don't know what I would expect in those situations. Now, when they play home games, it seems like they're awfully good and pretty consistent and are going to make their shots and hit their threes and play their defense. And then maybe you feel a little more comfortable in that situation. But on the road, it's a little more questionable, I think.
Well, let's move over to the Big 12 here. There are a couple of teams I want to touch on, and obviously Kansas being one of them. I mean, this Kansas team is, you know, they have a lot of success year after year under Bill Self. They've got plenty of veteran experience here on this team as well. They always tend to find a way to mix in some really athletic underclassmen as well. What do you see from Kansas here so far? I mean, are they a team that looks like they can just sort of start to assert their will in the Big 12, or are they going to be kind of up and down a little bit in conference play in terms of what's expected of them, you know, with some inflated numbers generally in the betting market?
Sure. This is a different Kansas team than past Kansas teams under Bill Self, I think. And I think that's something that's important to consider anytime you look at the Jayhawks. One of the things that sticks out is Kansas is playing a four-guard lineup for the first time under Self. They're using freshman Josh Jackson largely as a small ball power forward next to Landon Lucas. Some of that is that it just plays to the strengths of Kansas. They have a lot of really good guards. They don't have a lot of good front court players. And some of that is out of necessity. Their other freshman, Udoka Azubuike, tore some ligaments in his wrist and is out for the season, so they don't have the front court depth to really play two bigs. That translates, I guess, in terms of betting markets to meaning that Kansas is scoring more points than they have in the past. They play at a fast tempo. They shoot more threes. And, you know, I think in general, right, are putting up higher numbers in terms of points than they were. It also has translated on the defensive end to Kansas having one of its worst defenses under Self in terms of adjusted efficiency. They really are struggling to stop teams from making three-pointers. They're okay but not great defending inside of the arc against two-pointers because Landon Lucas is a fine positional defender and a big body, but he's certainly not someone who I would confuse with a rim protector. And so I think that this is kind of a fundamentally different Kansas team in the past. And if they're reliant on their offense and their shooting – right, they have Frank Mason, who's a National Player of the Year candidate. They have Devontae Graham, who's a 40% three-point shooter, I think, for his career. And Svi Mykhailiuk has developed into a 40% three-point shooter. Like, if they are reliant on that and consistently make those shots, then they're definitely a national title contender. It's just that there are going to be some realistic question marks about the defense that they play because so far it hasn't been good, and it's caused them to play some games that are probably closer than they would like to play.
So in that respect, with a different-looking Kansas team and a Kansas team, as you said, sort of running a four-guard lineup at times, not a whole lot of rim protection, which teams in the Big 12 are going to be the toughest matchups for them?
I think in terms of matchups, you know, West Virginia is really, really good. And that press defense, I think we saw last night, I want to say they forced Baylor into 29 or 28 turnovers or something like that, and that's a good Baylor team. West Virginia, I think, is the best team other than Kansas in the Big 12 because of that defense that they have. But in terms of a matchup, I actually like Kansas against West Virginia because with that four-guard lineup, they have plenty of ball handlers who can help get the ball up the court. And in Devontae Graham and Frank Mason, they have two experienced guards who have played against that defense for, well, in Graham's case, 3 years, in Mason's case, 4 years at this point. And then you add in a guy like Josh Jackson, who's got a nice handle and a great passing ability. I think that they match up pretty well. That may look stupid when Kansas goes to Morgantown later this month and West Virginia trounces them for 30 turnovers or something. But, you know, right now I wouldn't feel, you know, that bad if I were Kansas. Plus, at least in terms of the Big 12 long term, they always have Allen Fieldhouse. They don't lose very many games there. And defending your home court is kind of imperative when you're trying to win the conference titles in a double round robin format. West Virginia is the team that I would look at that's most likely to challenge Kansas, but just in terms of a one-on-one matchup, I like Kansas's, you know, chances against the Mountaineers.
One other team in the Big 12 I want to talk about because they've had some success here recently, but they're not having a whole lot of success this year. The Oklahoma Sooners. So obviously they've had some injury problems. Buddy Hield goes in the NFL draft. Jordan Woodard's been kind of in and out here so far this season. Is Oklahoma a team that can put this thing together, or are they going to be a Big 12 doormat for the foreseeable, I guess not for the foreseeable future, but for the rest of this season?
I think for the rest of this season, they're probably in quite a bit of trouble. They just don't have the offense that they need to make up for the questionable defense that they play. Last year they had, you know, Isaiah Cousins, they had Woodard, they had Hield, and they could just knock down tons and tons and tons of three-pointers. This year, only about 30%, 31% of their shots are coming from behind the arc, and they just don't have the guys that can make them at a high enough clip. One of the things that helped Oklahoma last year is Woodard was able to play as the off guard while Cousins played the point. And it really let Woodard kind of free up to make some of his shots. This year, he's having to play more point guard. There's more responsibility there. And I just don't think you're getting kind of the same production that you were getting out of him last year because of that. I think the role players are not as good. You know, it's just tough for me to imagine that they're going to be able to handle the kind of rigors of Big 12 play. Ken Pom right now has them projected to finish 4-14 in the conference. They've lost both their home games by double digits, admittedly to Kansas and Baylor, and they've lost two road games already to TCU and Kansas State. You know, it wouldn't be a stretch to call them right now the worst team in the Big 12, maybe outside of Texas, I suppose. But they're going to have a tough time winning very many games, I think, in the league. And, you know, it's kind of a downer because Buddy Hield was so fun to watch last year.
Well, a lot of people like to refer to the American Athletic Conference as kind of the sixth power conference in college football. And if you're looking for the sixth power conference in college basketball, it has to be the Big East, which is certainly off to a really, really strong start. You got a great game tonight between Butler and Creighton. Creighton laying about 5.5 in Omaha for that one. I guess those are the two teams that we can kind of start with here. And if you sort of want to break down this game a little bit for our listeners, I'm sure they would appreciate it. But, you know, everyone remembers Butler knocked off Villanova. You know, Creighton was sort of this darling team a few years ago with McDermott and all the jump shots that they took. Are both of these teams legit? Are they here to stay this year?
Probably, I think. I really, really like this Creighton team. And some of that is just that they're aesthetically pleasing to watch play basketball because they push the pace, they run the floor really fast, and their offense is super good. But I also just think that they're legitimately a really good basketball team. They're a lot of fun to watch. They score a lot of points. They have a lot of good players. They have one of the best backcourts in the country, right? Maurice Watson is a 5'10 point guard who's lightning quick, sprints down the floor as soon as he can, and tries to get into the lane. They added this year Marcus Foster, who transferred from Kansas State after his sophomore season. He was a total stud as a freshman for the Wildcats back in the day. Even put himself on NBA draft radar before deciding to come back to school, running into some problems with the coaching staff, et cetera. And now he's kind of lighting it up and back to his old self. I think you've had kind of a revelation in center Justin Patton, who runs the style of play. He's a good defensive player on the inside, even though their team defense as a whole isn't particularly good. So I really, really enjoy kind of the pieces that Creighton has. In terms of Butler, you know, they've got a couple of really good home wins this season. They beat Villanova. They've beaten Cincinnati at home. They have neutral court wins over Arizona and Indiana. So they kind of have the type of resume, I think, that lends itself to being somebody who can be competitive in March. Keelan Martin is an All-American style candidate who can kind of get buckets against just about anybody. They have a really efficient offense. And this year, I think that they're playing pretty decent defense. Now, the obvious question mark is when you look at their two losses this year, that's pretty bad, right? They lost at Indiana State and they lost at St. John's to open Big East play. I think in terms of a matchup tonight, right, it's probably something that I would favor Creighton in just because it's a home game and Creighton is going to make a lot more shots at home, you know, presumably than they're going to make on the road, even against a tough Butler defense. Butler in that game is going to want to slow the pace down and kind of grind it out against Creighton, and Creighton is going to want to get up and down the floor. So it's an interesting contrast of styles, but I think given that it's a Creighton home game, I would favor them in that one. You know, I looked earlier, the line was opened at 2, and it's already, like you said, to 5.5. So I think that most people are probably on Creighton in that one, despite, you know, how good Butler's been.
One more team in the Big East to look at here, Villanova. And it seemed like Villanova, they had a really tricky back-to-back on the road with Creighton and Butler. And, you know, Villanova came up short in that Butler game. And Jay Wright really downplayed it and said, hey, you know what? Give a lot of credit to Butler. They played well. They did what they wanted to do defensively. We couldn't get a whole lot going offensively. And, you know, just sort of chalked it up to one of those things. They struggle a little bit defensively with Marquette giving up 81 points. And then they just completely obliterate a top 15 team in Xavier, a team that a lot of people liked coming into the season. And you just sort of look at something like that. And for me, as somebody that, you know, let's say I'm somebody that's just kind of getting into college basketball now, and I'm really just looking at, you know, teams with their wins and losses and some of the things that they've done earlier in the year, to see a team bounce back like that in a two-game span, that's something that would give me a lot of confidence in the Wildcats.
I think that's totally fair confidence to have. They are the returning national title, and they won the national title last year. They're super experienced. They bring back a lot of players who played on that team Jalen Brunson, Chris Jenkins, Mikal Bridges, Josh Hart, all of those guys who were around when they won the title last year. One thing that I think is worth mentioning in that Butler game is Josh Hart had an off night, right? He's their best player. He's the National Player of the Year favorite, and he just, you know, kind of had an off night on the second, you know, like you said, away game of in 4 days against a top 25 opponent. And, you know, sometimes I think those things just happen, and you don't show up and you have a rough day on the road, and at the end of the day, you move on from there. I have a ton of confidence in Villanova going forward. I think they're probably by far the best team in the Big East. They, according to KenPom, have the best offense in the country. They do a great job scoring inside. Josh Hart has really evolved as a player who's not only just kind of a shooter and slasher on offense, but he can now play with the ball in his hands. He's become an excellent pick-and-roll ball handler, which, you know, just adds a dimension to their offense that didn't exist before. And so that's a team, like you said, they bounce back with wins over Marquette and a big, big win last night over Xavier. That's a team I'm fully confident in being able to handle kind of the rigors of the Big East.
Well, a team that a lot of people are going to like come March, and we had one of our guests yesterday, Sports Chew, to talk about grabbing a really good futures price on them for March Madness, is Michigan State. And we know what Tom Izzo's teams do, and we know that sometimes there are some struggles with that team in November, maybe into December as well. And then all of a sudden, by the time March rolls around, they look like a well-oiled machine, and they do this year after year after year. However, that loss to Penn State really doesn't look very good for this team. They've had guys in and out of the lineup as well. You know, Miles Bridges has kind of been out of the fray for a little bit. They're a two-possession favorite tonight against Minnesota. They're favored by 3.5 or 4, depending on where you look. Is Michigan State capable of putting this thing all together, and are they going to do it in short order?
You know, Michigan State has faced a lot of adversity this season. They're missing both of their best front court players because of injuries. It's unclear. One of those guys is already out for the year. The other one may or may not come back. They're also integrating a lot of pieces. It's Tom Izzo's best freshman class ever, but that means that they're having to put a lot of freshmen together in a situation where they probably haven't had to do that in the past. I think it is possible that Michigan State puts it together, but I think that putting it together in this instance probably means that, like, they make the Sweet 16 rather than they make the Final Four like they've done in years past when they've kind of put it together in March. I like the talent that is there. I don't know that I like the way the pieces together. Aaron Harris is a senior who averaged like 17, 18 points two or three years ago for West Virginia, and I think people expected him to have this kind of big leap forward as kind of a scorer and creator, and that hasn't really happened because he's just not that kind of player. He's a spot-up shooter who needs somebody else to help create for him. And so Michigan State, I think, is still in the process of figuring out who can create shots for them, who can kind of lead that offense after losing Denzel Valentine. And like you said, losing to Penn State's not a good look. Losing to Northeastern at home is definitely not a good look. And when you look up and down the resume, it's tough to find really quality wins. Like, their three best wins are Wichita State, Minnesota in overtime, and Northwestern. And, you know, I think if you look at the rest of the Big – or if you look at the rest of the Big Ten, it's hard to put them in that conversation with the top of the league, like Purdue and Wisconsin and you know, maybe even Indiana, although they're looking really rough right now, Minnesota, et cetera. It's tough to put them in that same conversation. I think that they can put it together and put together a little bit, maybe a mini run come March, but it's tough to say that they'll be that same type of Izzo team that comes out of nowhere and make the Final Four.
One more team I want to hit on here in the Big Ten, the Wisconsin Badgers. 13-3 on the year, all three of their losses away from home against top 25 caliber teams. And of course, we know Creighton, who was 22 in that game, a little bit higher up the ranks now, lost to North Carolina in a neutral in Maui. And then this most recent loss to Purdue on the road, in that back-to-back Indiana trip with the Hoosiers and the Boilermakers. So definitely an understandable loss there. What's the upside of Greg Gard's team? And, you know, is this a team that can consistently take care of its business in the Big Ten this year?
I would think so. They're a super talented squad. I really have grown to like Ethan Happ, who's their sophomore center. Just because of all kind of the different things that he does on the floor, right? He can score inside. He's got a nice set of post moves. He's a really good rebounder on both ends of the floor. And he is a sneaky good passer, which is really entertaining to watch because you don't see a lot of 6'10" guys kind of passing in the way that he does. Nigel Hayes seems to be finding kind of a role that he played a couple of years ago on that team that beat Kentucky and then lost to Duke in the finals of the NCAA tournament. He is much better, I think, as kind of a complimentary role player than he is as a star. And he seems to be kind of accepting that role with this particular team. You know, you're always going to get in a Wisconsin a team that likes to grind out the pace and play close games because of that. But their offense is always going to be super efficient. They're not going to make a ton of mistakes, and they're always going to guard somebody pretty well. So, you know, given the quality of competition in the Big Ten this year, I think really the only team that would concern me kind of is Purdue. But what it looks like is they don't play Purdue the rest of the way anyway. So they're kind of done already. And then their big matchups then are like Michigan State, Minnesota, Michigan. I would feel really comfortable with the Badgers in just about all of those matchups.
Let's go out west here, and then we'll come back east, touch on just a couple more teams here on this segment. First one being UCLA. UCLA 16-1 on the year. Their only loss, they lost by a bucket at the buzzer in Oregon in what was a really good game if you like offense, not so great of a game if you like defense, because there wasn't a whole lot of it played there in that one. What do you feel like for UCLA here? I mean, is this a team that can keep this thing going? Are they going to run into some difficulties in the Pac-12? How do you see them working out?
Yeah, there's not ever going to be a whole lot of defense played in UCLA games, I think, just as a product of the way that the Bruins kind of have oriented their team. They don't play a lot of it. They just try to kind of outscore you, and they do a pretty good job of that. They're the best three-point shooting team in the country. They score inside the arc as well. Lonzo Ball has been fantastic and really transformed the way that that team plays in terms of sharing the ball on offense and kind of creating open looks. With Thomas Wells playing in the center, they basically have five guys who can make shots from 15, 18 feet out, and most of their guys can shoot threes. And so that makes them a really, really difficult team to guard. In terms of what to expect about them versus the rest of the Pac-12, you know, I think at the top of the Pac-12, you've got kind of them, you've got Arizona, and you've got probably Oregon as the three best teams in that league. You could throw USC in there, but I think they're probably a step below those teams. I think UCLA is probably the favorite to win that conference right now. They've still got two games against Arizona to go, and one game left, I think, against Oregon. But their offense is so good, and it makes it so difficult for teams to play with them, because you really do have to score with them for 40 minutes, because you're not really going to slow them down, right? Even that game against Oregon was 89-87, and the reason that Oregon was able to win that game is because they were making a bunch of outside shots that are kind of uncharacteristic for Oregon to make. And so they're going to put pressure on you even though they don't play great defense, and you just have to be able to consistently score for 40 minutes of a basketball game. And I'm not sure that there are a lot of teams in the country that can do that, and in the Pac-12, you know, there's even fewer.
One more team to hit on here, a team that, again, obviously a perennial contender for the national championship, the Kentucky Wildcats. What do you make of this team? I mean, a couple of losses so far, UCLA and that game at Louisville and that rivalry matchup that usually seems to be pretty closely contested, but Kentucky, you know, I mean, generally that's a game that they do win, and they take a lot of pride in winning. So what do you think about the Wildcats? I mean, are they just so much better than everyone else in the SEC that they can – cover the big numbers that they're going to face, or will they face some challenges here in league play?
They're going to get a couple of challenges, I think, from Florida and from South Carolina. Those are two teams that I think are okay, but because of the way the SEC schedule works, they only play South Carolina at Rupp Arena, so they'll probably win that one big. They do play at Florida, which is projected to be a pretty close game and could be one of the few losses that they get before they kind of hit postseason play. The thing about Kentucky to me is this is a team that's designed to absolutely destroy, you know, bad to mediocre teams because of the way they pressure the ball, because of the way they can create turnovers, because of how good they are defensively. And when they're when they do create those turnovers, they get out in transition so fast that it's nearly impossible to stop them. This team is a little different from the way John Calipari teams have been in the past, in that he's letting them get up and down the floor. And that allows them to blow some folks out, and it really allows them to blow people out at home where Malik Monk can get hot and make a lot of shots. You saw that last week when they blew out Texas A&M by 42 and they beat Arkansas by 26. Now, the thing that concerns me, though, is that with such a young team, there are always question marks of just how good they'll be on the road. And last night, you kind of saw that when they played Vanderbilt at Vanderbilt to a six-point game that was close down into the final minutes, came down into the final few possessions, and they needed a late Malik Monk shot to kind of push it over the edge. So that's the place where I think Kentucky could get tripped up, is just somewhere on the road against one of these kind of decent but not great SEC teams, where the freshmen just have kind of an off game because they're not ready to play in those environments yet necessarily. But at home, I fully expect them to kind of just run other teams, even the good ones, into the ground, because they really punish you for the mistakes that you make.
A lot of excellent college basketball thoughts here today from Chris Stone. I mentioned a couple of the places where you've got bylines. Anything you've written recently that you want to share with our listeners?
I wrote a little bit about Dwayne Bacon and his three-point shooting. Feel pretty good about that one after they beat Duke last night. And then over at the Step Back, I'm doing a lot of NBA draft work to kind of get people ready for that coming up in June.
And at C Stone Hoops on Twitter. Chris, thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll talk to you again real soon.
Absolutely. Enjoyed it. Have a good one.
Some great college basketball stuff there. And again, like I said, one of the premises of that segment there is that I feel like a lot of people that are just now getting into college basketball going to go back to the teams that they know, going back to what's familiar, teams they feel like they can trust. So I wanted to make sure that I hit on a lot of those teams there during that segment. Go ahead and bring in our second guest of today's show. That is Wes Reynolds, at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Hey, Adam, how are you?
Doing very well. Appreciate your time. Good to get you back on the program here. Lots of stuff to cover during our segment. I guess I'll let you decide. You want to start with the PGA Tour event this weekend, or do you want to start with the NFL playoffs?
We can go ahead and start with the golf.
All right, let's start with the golf here. We got the Sony Open in Hawaii at Wailea Country Club in Honolulu. You know, this is the first full field event of the 2017 calendar year. Last week, of course, the Tournament of Champions, only 32 players in that. Justin Thomas winds up taking care of that one. As you're going into a new golf season here, of course, the wraparound format started back in October. What sorts of adjustments are you making in terms of, you know, what you're looking at, maybe some different statistics, different angles? Have you noticed anything that you've decided to do a little bit differently this year?
Well, I think you have to look at just a few different angles. I mean, you want to obviously take into consideration course form, you know, some of the guys that might have been in good form in the silly season, kind of in late November and into December. So you're looking at that. You're looking at, you know, past event form. I mean, all the usual stuff that you would usually look into. But there are different things at play this year in terms of a new season. I mean, you have a fair amount of guys that contracts have come due and contracts have come up, so they've made equipment changes. And especially with some of these players getting out of last year, the major adjustment was the guys kind of got out to a slow start playing the PXG, the new Parsons Extreme Golf equipment. But now you have a lot of guys that are kind of piecemealing their stuff right now because they don't have new contract sign, especially the Nike guys. Since Nike got out of the golf equipment business, I mean, guys will still have their apparel deals, but they're not going to have equipment. So you got guys like, you know, Rory McIlroy, who's playing in South Africa at the South Africa Open, playing some Callaway this week, but he's not under contract with Callaway. You got guys playing maybe a TaylorMade driver and Titleist irons, guys playing new balls this year. A lot of those guys have went to Titleist balls. Of course, Tiger is going to be playing the Bridgestone when he starts here in a couple weeks. So you got a lot of equipment changes, a lot of ball changes, and that like. And it takes some time for guys to get comfortable with the new equipment.
So was that something that you shied away from here in the Sony Open as well as that tournament in South Africa? Did you sort of look to either stay away from those guys in the futures market or fade them in the matchups market?
You know, a little bit. I mean, it was a case-by-case basis in terms of doing that. And, I mean, you know, the guys that put these prices up, I mean, they know who's kind of switched and who hasn't. I mean, there was one I went against. I went against Tony Finau, in a matchup with Kevin Na. And there's a few guys, you know, in the off season that have kids, you know, they call it the nappy factor, where they either have kids or they get married or what have you. So, you know, Na was kind of one of those guys in the off season, and usually those guys, you know, tend to play well over time. If it's not the first tournament right away, but they'll tend to kind of pay off a little bit in the long run for that. But I mean, a lot of these guys that are matched up with each other, you know, they haven't done as many where you're totally fading guys with equipment. I mean, one guy that I really usually like at this tournament who always plays well here is Russell Henley, but I didn't play him this week because he's with new equipment. He's now with Titleist. So, you know, he has the course form, and he's kind of a horse for course here, but I didn't end up playing him, but I didn't necessarily fade him either.
So what can you tell me about this course here? What types of players were you looking for? Which types of players does it favor?
While I actually, it's a little bit different than the course we saw at Kapalua last week. It's still Bermuda grass. It's a par 70. It's just over 7,000 yards. So it is not a super long course. So, you know, it's definitely not a course that necessarily favors the bombers. It's a course where, you know, ball striking's a premium. It's not a particularly hard course. Last year, it actually, I think, rated as the sixth easiest course that they played on tour. It was 45 out of 50 in terms of difficulty. But, I mean, you know, it's, you know, you'll get some winds, some light winds here. You know, I would expect the scoring's probably going to be around 18 to 20 under come Sunday near the end of the tournament. That around that range is going to be your winner. It's got a little bit of correlation with something like Colonial being a par 70. You know, there's a kind of a course correlation with Harbortown in Hilton Head. So it was a Rainer design, and the only really other design on the tour that these guys play regularly is the old white TPC course that they use for the Greenbrier. But, you know, you're looking at Bermuda, which is what they putted on last week. So, you know, looking at guys that typically putt well on those fast greens, and, you know, that's what you're looking at. But, I mean, I think, you know, you have a pretty diverse field this week. The quality of this field is probably the best it's been in many years. You usually get a couple top players, but, I mean, having Spieth and having Matsuyama in the field and having some pretty big names, having Thomas, who won last week, Justin Rose, Brandon Grace, Brent Snedeker. You know, you got a lot of quality here at the top.
Hey, you certainly do. And for our listeners here, I want to keep in mind as we go through these golf events throughout the year, you know, I'm going to talk about shopping around for the best price, and some of the best prices this week come at DSI Sportsbook. Others do not. But for our Bang the Book Radio listeners, you can use the promo code BTB Radio. That'll get you a $10 free bet just for signing up, an additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. So as we go through here, I'll compare and contrast some of these futures prices. One that stands out to me, actually, you don't have this guy on your card, but Paul Casey is only 15 to 1 at DSI. He's 32 to 1 at Five Dimes. So obviously that speaks to how important it is to shop around for the best price. But Spieth and Matsuyama, both in the 6 to 8 to 1 range, so not really a whole lot of value on those guys. But one guy that you do have on your sheet this week, a two-time winner here in back-to-back years, 2014 and 2015, Jimmy Walker.
Yeah, and I was considering staying away from Walker, you know, in the threat that he might get overpriced, and he actually has gotten bet against a little bit in the in some of the matchups markets, which really surprises me. But you know, played very well last week at Kapalua, and he putts real well. I mean, these greens of Wailea are pretty flat and they're pretty fast. and, you know, a two-time winner here. I mean, his form is just really good. I mean, he was kind of burning the edges with the putter and, you know, missed a couple close ones, or he might have been in contention at the end with Thomas and Matsuyama. He's using a shorter driver now, and his accuracy, I think, is improving. And this is a course where, you know, you could keep the driver in the bag on a lot of holes with it only being 7,000 yards. He was the first-round leader last week at Kapalua, ended up finishing top 10. He was sixth in greens in regulation, first in proximity to the hole, seventh in putting. You know, this is a guy that really plays well at this event. Two-time winner, fourth here in 2011, 13th last year. He's won in California. He's always played pretty well at the West Coast Swing. So if he's striking the ball like he did last week in Honolulu, you would expect that he's going to contend.
And looking down your sheet here, I think my favorite play on your card, and I actually threw this guy in my daily fantasy article where I look for value picks, is Russell Knox. A European has never won this event, but he's played very, very well here. And one thing that's important to keep in mind about this tournament is that, as you said, it's a very easy course. So the cut line's been 2 under, 1 under, even par, something like that over the last few years. So some guys have had some decent rounds here that just haven't happened to make the cut. That hasn't really been the case for Russell Knox. You know, he shot a 65 in the second round last year, went 66 and 65 in 2015 to start this thing off. Is it a course form play, or do you like his form overall coming into this event?
It's a little bit of both. I think that this is a much better course for him than Kapalua was, where I think Kapalua, you know, he's not a particularly long hitter. So Kapalua, which was a lot longer of a course, was kind of, you know, going to be a tough nut to crack for him. He was actually in the top 10 going into the final round, but shot one over. And when you shoot one over at a place like Kapalua, you're going to slip down the leaderboard. And he ended up finishing 17th, but played well in December and November, played well at the Shark Shootout, was third in the at Mayakoba, was ninth in Sichuan in China, 10th in Malaysia. So he's been pretty consistent lately, and he's obviously a very good ball striker, and I think that's something that's key here. He's been putting the ball well. He's been gaining strokes putting, and I think this course kind of plays to his strengths. I mean, if you look at some of the courses he's won on, Sichuan back in China in 2015, TPC River Highlands last year, and some of the other courses he's played well on, Harbortown in South Carolina, the courses in Mexico. All of those courses are all Memphis as well. He's had a top 10 there. They're all short, like par 70 type courses, par 71, you know, 7,000, maybe 7,100 yards. So similar types of layouts is what he's done very well at. And he was playing competitive golf to end the year last year. So, you know, this is a guy I think you're getting a decent price on this week that's kind of being ignored and a little bit under the radar.
I want to make sure that we spend some time on the NFL playoffs here during this segment, but you got a long list over on your Twitter feed. Again, that's at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Pick a couple of these guys out and tell our listeners why you like them.
Okay, let me actually pull my list up here. A couple guys I looked at here, and a couple guys I ended up playing. Charles Howell is a guy I ended up playing at 45-1, simply because if you look at the long-term form, he's probably got the best of anybody. And I think he's played this event 15 times. He's played this event every year. And, I mean, the guy's got eight top 10 finishes in this event since 2002. He's done everything but win the event. And the guy that just kind of fits this profile a little bit, Chris Kirk is another guy I like at 50-1. And you've seen, if you look at his career, he's very good on Bermuda grass and really putts well on the surface. Some guys putt well on bent grass, some guys on Bermuda, but he really likes the Bermuda and was runner-up here back in 2014. A couple other guys, if you're looking at long shots, Sean O'Hare, Jamie Lovemark. Sean O'Hare actually has kind of gotten back on track with his game after he went away for a while. He was second at the Barclays. He was 10th out in Vegas at TTC Summerlin, was fifth at the Franklin Templeton Shootout, which is the old shark shootout they have down in Florida in December, where you have a partner. Another Bermuda guy was second here back in 2012. Lovemark was seventh here last year and was also on similar greens at Sea Island, which is where they have the RSM Classic in the fall series, was sixth last time out there. So, you know, a lot of those guys that I took at long shots are kind of Bermuda specialists, I think. Brian Stewart, Jamie Lovemark, Sean O'Hare, a couple others I didn't play. The McGirt play I made, Bill McGirt at 66-1, was more of kind of a form guy. So, you know, that's why I included him on there.
Well, move over to the NFL side here, where we have all eight division champions left standing in the divisional round. All four home teams last week won and covered the numbers. So I don't think it's really a big surprise that early action in three of these four games coming in on the home favorites. We've seen a little bit of buyback on Houston here as a 15-point underdog, which is probably just a numbers grab because, you know, it is the playoffs and it is a number north of two touchdowns. But as you're looking over these four NFL games here this weekend, which one stands out to you as maybe having the most line value?
In terms of line value, there's nothing really in terms of when you use that term that stands out to me. But, I mean, I kind of have been looking at Kansas City, and the money seems to have come on Kansas City. Now, Kansas City historically, at least under Reed, has been a little better, as has been way better as an underdog than a favorite. I don't have the exact numbers or the point spread records in front of me, but I think if you're looking at this, you know, the media has kind of said, oh, well, Big Ben's going to play. He's going to be ready. Well, of course he's probably going to play, but how effective is he going to be? And, you know, people might tend to fall in love with the team that they saw the previous week. You know, they won against Miami, and I'll admit I got that one wrong. I took Miami for the first half, and they didn't have a chance. Pittsburgh jumped on them, out on them right away. But, you know, that was going to be a tough nut to crack for Miami, playing in cold weather. You're obviously playing with your backup quarterback. You had Pittsburgh had their main skill position guys well rested. But I would lean probably, I have not made a bet yet and walked in the divisional weekend at this point, but I would probably look to Kansas City is the one that stands out to me a little bit of the four right now.
What do you think about this Seattle and Atlanta game? I mean, obviously we've got some sharp money coming in on Atlanta. They've pushed this number all the way up to five. Where do you think the public comes in for a game like that? Because you've got an Atlanta team, doesn't have a whole lot of playoff success under Matt Ryan. Know that Seattle does. A lot of people still, you know, will utter that mantra of defense wins championships, and Seattle, even without Earl Thomas, should have the better defense here in this game. Where do you see that number going? Do you think we get back down to a manageable four for those that want to back Atlanta, or is it going to kind of sit in this dead zone or maybe even go up?
I actually think it's going to come back down a little bit as you get to the weekend. I could see it settling maybe four and a half. I mean, it seems like the sharper guys, at least early in the week, seem to be more believers in Atlanta, despite the lack of playoff experience, than they are of Seattle. I mean, you know, not to take anything away from them, but you had that game was a one-score game going into the fourth quarter with Detroit, and you know, The thumb and it, you know, the finger injury was obviously affecting Stafford, and their offense just really never got going. And the Lions, you know, have been pretty banged up as they kind of headed down the stretch of the season. I mean, with no Riddick and the running game being pretty limited, even though Zach Zinner filled in admirably, you just didn't have the playmakers that you needed against Seattle. And when Seattle can get a lead and they can, you know, pin their ears back and bring pressure, it's not an easy team to necessarily come back against. But I think that you will see some Seattle money come back on this game a little bit. I wouldn't expect it to get slammed too much on Seattle, but I think you'll see it probably go back to four.
I'll be curious to see what happens with this Houston and New England line, because I think in a lot of respects, it's very hard to touch this game. I mean, you know, New England going to be the preferred public side because they're New England and, you know, no one thinks a whole lot of Houston, but at the same time, I can't even see, you know, even the squarest of public bettors running to back a 15-point favorite here in the playoffs. So if you had to sort of guess where this line may go, where the more influential action would be, what do you think?
Yeah, and I mean, the books put this they put this in a spot, too, to kind of protect themselves a little bit from teasers. I mean, I suppose you'll have people teasing New England down below 10. I mean, it's obviously not something where you can get it below a touchdown or, you know, do those kind of Stanford Wong teasers in between a 3 and a 7. So you will see some people probably tease New England down to or try to get it under 10. I mean, if you look at some of these lines, sometimes when you see these, like you notice that 5 Dimes right now has New England minus 16.5 plus $1.05. Well, that's a teaser protection deal. The Mirage minus 17 plus $1.05, because they don't want to get any teaser money on New England. So that's the way the books kind of protect themselves. But I don't. This is probably going to be settling here. I mean, you'll have some guys. I mean, you kind of saw it a little bit at the 16, and maybe the Rogue 17s that showed some guys, you know, went ahead and took just a numbers play just to kind of have it. But I don't really see this number rising too much. I think it's kind of going to go back and forth and stay within this range. I don't see it getting above 17, and I don't see it getting to 14 or below, because you know, if it gets to 14 or below, or, you know, below 14, obviously you're going to see some money come in on New England to take that number. But if it gets above 17, you're probably going to see people want to take Houston, you know, and just making numbers plays. But yeah, this is a pretty hard game to bet because nobody's really giving this team a chance. New England, to me, at least looks like the best team in the league. That doesn't necessarily mean they'll win the Super Bowl, but they're the team I probably would be the most sure of the 8 teams remaining in the playoffs.
Well, you got Green Bay and Dallas here. Dallas, a 4.5-point favorite in this one. Looks like the initial money has come in a little bit on Dallas. The Chris books threatening to go up to 5. We'll see if that actually happens. But Green Bay was supposed to be in not a tough spot necessarily, but was supposed to play the most competitive game of the weekend last week. And they looked pretty good against the Giants. Now, the Giants had some self-inflicted mistakes, but Aaron Rodgers is just, I mean, I don't know if I've seen a guy in recent years that has been as locked in over the last 6 or 7 weeks as Aaron Rodgers has been. You feel like Green Bay is getting a little bit disrespected in this game, or is this a case where, because of what Dallas does, because you would think that they should be able to limit Aaron Rodgers' possessions, that this is where Green Bay kind of hits the wall a little bit?
Well, I think this is going to be just a little bit like the game last week from the betting perspective. I mean, the only game that I felt was really even, I mean, it was a little even with Houston and Oakland, but it had gone north of 3.5. But Green Bay and the Giants probably had the most even betting for the books because you had plenty of Giants money out there. I mean, it was not one-sided at all. And I think you'll get Green Bay money here as you get closer to Sunday. And I think you'll obviously get Dallas money. I mean, you got two high-profile. I hesitate to use the term public teams, but they're usually teams that get a lot of action, and they're facing each other. So, I mean, I think Green Bay comes in as the hot team, and I think with Dallas, they finally have lived up to the expectations that so many people had about them. You know, so many people thought, oh, this Cowboy team, they've got to be good, and they've always disappointed. Well, this year it hasn't happened, but now you've got these two young guys, first playoff experience, first time ever doing it. So there's always going to be a little bit of question in terms of how they're going to react because they've never been there before. Now, the good thing for them is that they've got arguably the best offensive line in the league, and the team that they're playing also may want to make that argument as the best offensive line in the league because of their superior pass protection. I think they're the best at protecting in the league. I mean, Aaron Rodgers is playing so well because he has, it seems like, an hour every snap to throw the football, and he can make plays, and because of his mobility, he just finds guys. I mean, it's amazing how they do it and how high he throws that ball in the air, and they practice that for the Hail Mary, you know, throwing that ball 70 feet in the air. And he is pretty dialed in here, but I don't know necessarily if Green Bay is getting disrespected. I mean, I think, you know, people love to bet Dallas, and they cashed most of the year. Usually you see these good teams get priced so high that their spread record is not necessarily great, but they haven't been able to put prices high enough on New England and Dallas. Dallas kind of late in the season, the line caught up to them, and as they started to rest some guys, they weren't able to cover their last couple games. But I think, you know, you're going to see, I think, more of an even betting trend in this game as you get to Sunday.
So what's your approach to the NFL playoffs? Because, again, in theory, much like the college football playoff national championship game that we saw on Monday night, these should be the sharpest lines of the year. And it should be that way each successive week where you've got fewer games, you've got the larger sample sizes, you know, who's going to bet what, which will probably be the sharp side, which will be the public side, all that type of thing. So, you know, obviously you're a little bit different than some of our other guests, the handicappers that sell selections, because they have to do things a little bit differently, give their clients enough lead time to make these plays, you know, that type of thing. But for you, what is your approach? Do you sort of wait until game day, maybe go fade the public contrarian? How do you play it?
You know, that is one option. I mean, with a lot of these lines, you know, I think that the lines by and large are pretty accurate. I mean, just when I say accurate, that doesn't mean if a team covers easily that necessarily that these books had the wrong line. I mean, you know, people were saying that a little bit about the Houston-Oakland game last week, you know, when Houston went to -4 and they covered pretty easily and won by near 2 touchdowns. That doesn't mean necessarily that -4 was the wrong line. I mean, were you really going to make Houston a 6.5 or 7-point favorite over Oakland, even with Connor Cook at quarterback, knowing that Brock Osweiler had lost his starting job just 2 weeks ago? Well, of course people were going to come in on Oakland if it was that price. So, you know, you got to look at different ways to bet this. I think you look at quarters, you look at first halves, you look at second halves. I mean, there's a lot of inventory. I mean, number one, the books always have to put lines on the games, but you don't necessarily have to bet them. Or you could take the different forms of inventory. That means looking at first halves. That means looking at first quarters. That means looking at team totals. That means seeing if you could find good teaser spots with some of these games. So, you know, that's how I kind of look at it. I mean, you know, with some of the folks that kind of sell selections, I mean, you know, obviously selling selections, the NFL is what drives the bus for those that are the quote-unquote service advisors or touts, whatever you want to call them. So they're obviously going to have some kind of play on the NFL. You don't know how strong it is or how weak it is, but I mean, you know, that's what they got to sell because that's what the consumers want to buy, or NFL picks. So, I mean, that's just the way it is in that regard. But a guy like me, you know, I may wait around a little bit or see, you know, if there's something I can find in a first quarter or second quarter, because I look at these games and, you know, I guarantee you I won't bet just a straight point spread 11-10 on each of these four games. because I just they don't all stand out to me. So that's the way I kind of approach that.
A lot of excellent insight today on both golf and the NFL from Wes Reynolds. You can follow him on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Wes, appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us, man. We'll talk to you again next week.
Hey, Adam, thanks for having me, and Happy New Year to you and all your listeners.
Great stuff there. A couple of really strong guests here today, and hopefully listeners are able to take advantage of a lot of those good bits of information that they shared with us here on today's show. Coming up on Thursday, we'll have our 90-minute mega show. We'll have Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com to kick things off. We'll wrap up the college football season with him, then look ahead to these four NFL playoff games. After him, we'll be joined by Ralph Michaels of WagerTalk.com for this week's college basketball capping segment. We'll get some thoughts from him on probably some of the things that I discussed there with Chris Stone. We'll get a reinforcement of some of those topics. Also, if he does the same thing as last week, he'll give us his situational and technical plays of the week. So we'll see if that's something that he wants to share with us. Then our final segment for tomorrow, our UFC predictions with Primetown segment with Jay Primetown for Fight Night 103, that coming up in Phoenix here this weekend. A pretty interesting card on the UFC side to talk about. So that'll be our Thursday show. Friday, still working on a first guest, but we'll also have the odds report with Brent from DSI Sportsbook. So lots of good stuff coming your way here this week on Bang the Book Radio. Make sure you head on over to bangthebook.com. Check out everything that's available at your disposal. We've got all kinds of game preview write-ups, situational betting articles for NBA, NHL, college basketball. Lots of good stuff going on over there. The sportsbook reviews, matchup data, everything you could possibly want. We are your one-stop shop for all of your sports betting needs and information. So thank you very much for joining me, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.